Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, author, and journalist Ian Todd, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our fourth look at the murder of Olivia Christian. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Official, or Deathcast Podcast. You can find me on most social media platforms underneath any one of those monikers. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, leave a 5-star review, and follow the show. Way when new episodes drop, you get them downloaded automatically. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon. The first letter of each word is capitalized in it. Again, that's tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, or you can just go to Patreon and search for the Deathcast, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content such as the relook we are currently undertaking at the Atlanta child murders. And for the month of December, if you sign up, you get half off your first month. That's on all tiers. And I want to point out that no matter what tier you go for, you get all of the content. So if you go for the $1.99 tier, you're getting the same content as the people that are signed up to the $4.99 tier. And right now, until December 31st, you can get half off the first month. You can also gift people a subscription. So if there's somebody you think that might like this show, might like the type of content that I provide, you can actually gift it to them. Please consider it. It really does make a difference to this show, the quality of the show, as well as help the show continue moving forward. And I have to give a shout out to my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony. Also, I need to shout out Samantha and Debbie from True Crime University. They are in the Deathcaster tiers. Thank you guys so, so much for your support. All right, now that all that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last time, Hampton PD Detective Meyer was looking into an individual by the name of Reuben Moore. We had gone over Moore's very extensive and violent criminal history, and he noticed numerous striking parallels between the murder of Olivia Christian and the rapes, attempted rapes, murders, and attempted murders of various other white women in and around Hampton, Virginia, starting in the mid-1960s. Detective Meyer started really looking into these cases, making contact with the various survivors where he could. Specifically, he looked at the murder of Helen Sturgis in 1972, and he was stunned to discover a connection between Sturgis and the rape of Julia Wolfe. What he discovered was that the house that Sturgis was in was very close to the home that Julia Moore lived in. The houses were roughly 500 yards away from each other. What's more, looking through the police files on Wolfe's sexual assault, he discovered an addendum which stated that Wolfe had contacted the police on February 6th of 1972, informing officers that she had seen Moore in her backyard. He had told her to come to him because he wanted to show her something. She had run inside, locking the door behind her, and contacted the police. And as she was on the phone with the police, she heard Moore attempting to break into her home, and he was unable to do so. How does this link everything together? Helen Sturgis was murdered on February 6th of 1972. He had returned to Julia Wolfe's house almost 3 months after he had sexually assaulted her. Now, Reuben Moore would end up being charged with Julia Wolfe's sexual assault on February 9th. Meyer came to the conclusion that Helen Moore had in fact been murdered in an attempt to intimidate Miss Moore. He tracked down more information on the other cases, reaching out to areas such as Newport News, who informed him that they had nothing that would be of evidentiary value, as most of their older police files had been damaged or destroyed in a warehouse fire during the 1990s. Another avenue that Meyer pursued was an addendum in the Dennis Worley case file that stated when Moore was arrested, there had been a New Testament Bible with the name Linda Williamson written inside, as well as a leather keychain that bore the name Kathy. As for the Bible, he learned that a woman who lived nearby Worley's apartment in 1982 did in fact bear the name Linda Williamson, had such a Bible, although she stated she had never been a victim of sexual assault. However, he was unable to find anything matching the name Catherine or Kathy for rapes, attempted rapes, murders, or attempted murders in the nearby areas. One case that he stumbled upon was the murder of Linda Sykes, which had gone unsolved. This was also from 1981. Linda Diane Sykes was a 21-year-old student at Christopher Newport University. On the afternoon of February 24th, 1981, her mother had returned home to find water pouring from the ceiling in the house, and upon going upstairs had discovered her daughter's body lying nude inside the filled bathtub, which was still running. The young woman had been beaten, strangled, and stabbed. And while Meyer noted that Linda Sykes was African-American, she was of such light skin that Meyer believed Moore may have mistaken her for a Caucasian woman when he struck. Now, there is a bit of a difference in the MO with the water being left running in the bathtub and the body inside of the bath. However, if we recall from earlier cases involving Reuben Moore, there's at least one instance where he forced a victim to wash her genitals after he sexually assaulted her. Linda's wallet had been stolen, and a nearby 7-Eleven, which during this point in time did not have surveillance cameras, contacted police to let them know that a customer had spent a blood-stained $1 bill inside of their store. This they did after learning of Linda's murder. Digging deeper, Myers learned that Linda's father, who had since passed away, had been a masonry contractor who had run their business from the home. And he theorized that it was very possible that Reuben Moore had worked for this man and had thus become acquainted with both the layout of the house as well as with the Sykes' daughter, Linda. However, he was not able to prove this as the business records were long gone. I often wonder in cases like this if it would have been possible to go and attempt to extract a suspect's tax returns. I mean, we're assuming Reuben Moore was paying taxes on his earnings to try and see if a suspect had, in fact, worked for a particular company during a period of time, but alas, it does not appear as though they pursued this avenue very closely. With all of this coupled with Anita Purcell's positive identification of Reuben Moore from a photo lineup, the police put Moore under surveillance, and immediately he starts complaining, saying that they are stalking him and harassing him. Myers confronts Moore and asks him to come back in. Moore states he'll come in and talk to the officer after Thanksgiving, however, he does not do so, which leads Meyer to visit Moore yet again. With Moore claiming that he'd had a stroke from the stress that the officer and his surveillance were putting on him, Meyer brushes this aside and informs him that the DNA test came back and that the witness had also positively identified Reuben Moore as the man she had seen. Moore is stated to have had no reaction. So Meyer throws out the fact that he's closing out the Christian case, but he's also working on closing out another case, that of Helen Sturgis. Again, Moore plays dumb, claiming to have had no idea where the area was. So as he's waiting for Moore to come in and talk to him, Meyer gets down to brass tacks, tracking down the auto body shop Moore had worked at back in the 1970s, and he learns that the Hampton police cars of the 70s had black bodies and white tops, and that the vehicles had often been sold at auction. This struck a chord with Meyer, as during one conversation with Reuben, wherein he stated he recalled painting an old black-bodied, white-topped police car at some point, and Myers was able to juxtapose this to, it's very possible Reuben Moore himself had purchased the car and taken it to his place of employment in order to have it painted. However, he was unable to prove this, as the DMV records did not go back far enough. On January 17th, 2014, Detective Meyer made contact with Reuben Moore again, this time going to his residence and speaking with him. Again, Moore reiterated that he was being harassed and stalked, and stated that his daughter told him not to speak with the officers. Myers basically told him, well, if that's the game you want to play, then that's what we'll play, and whatever happens is going to happen. At which point he left. Not long after returning to the Hampton Police Department, he got a phone call stating that Reuben Moore was there to see him. During this interview, Meyer showed him pictures, starting with the murder of Helen Sturgis, letting him know that his DNA had been found inside of her body. Moore insisted that it could not have been him, that he hadn't done anything since getting out of prison, which Meyer quickly pointed out that this particular crime had happened well before he was in prison. Moore became agitated, and Meyer switches tactics on him, talking about the black and white car seen outside of Sturgis's home on the night of her killing. Quote, okay, the car you prepped at Earl Scheib, you thought it was a trooper's car. First, are you certain it was a trooper's car, not an old Hampton cruiser? And two, was it a car you purchased at auction, or were you fixing it for someone else? Moore, no, somebody else's car. Meyer, are you certain it wasn't a Hampton car? Only Hampton had the black with the white top. Meyer, I can't remember that far back. Meyer, okay, The reason why I asked is because someone saw you in that car in front of her house. The puzzle pieces fit. They saw you in that car. I'm like, well, he probably borrowed the car. Who cares? He was probably doing yard work or something for her. More. I don't remember all that. I don't know this woman. After a pause in conversation, Moore returns with, quote, I serve my time. I'm trying to do what's right. Meyer then removes a crime scene photograph of Olivia Christian's body and asks Reuben if this picture looks familiar to him. Reuben Moore mumbled something, although the tape recorder was unable to pick it up. Meyer, that's where your hair came back to, under her fingernail. Your car was seen backing into a space in the very back of the parking lot. You were seen getting out of your car. That's how we came up with that sketch that was put in the newspaper. With the blue hat, that's the car she identified. Just 2 months ago, I had her in this very room and she positively identified you in a photo spread and then your hair matches. Meyer then tries to play it up like maybe Olivia and Reuben had had a relationship. More than states that he had would never do anything like that. Quote, no, I ain't never stabbed no woman. You're looking at a different Reuben Moore. Whatever happened in my past, it's in my past. Moore plays around a little bit more, trying to act as though he has no idea what the officer's talking about, even after Meyer points out that Reuben had the entire week off from work. Basically, at this point, Moore tries to pass the buck, stating that whatever and whoever he had been back during that period of life, he is no longer that person, and thus he has no responsibility for the things that happened then. After a few more minutes of trying to get information from Reuben Moore, Moore leaves the police department. Following this, Officer Meyer contacts the detectives who had worked the case back in 1981. He learns that one of the detectives' wives had returned to their home one evening to find a man standing in their driveway. The man introduced himself as Reuben Moore and began to walk towards the woman's car. The woman, feeling threatened, removed a handgun she kept inside of her purse for protection and fired it into the air, scaring off Moore. Patrol cars quickly descended on the scene. Although Moore was not found and no trace of him was discovered. In March 2014, Detective Meyer ends up contacting Denise Worley, who, if you'll recall, was the rape victim from 1982. She confirms the details of the crime and eventually states that she doesn't want to open old wounds, but if Moore goes to trial again for murder, she will testify. During the course of his reinvestigation, Officer Meyer had been in contact with an FBI agent, bouncing things off of her, trying to get her perspective on things and find a way forward. After a meeting with the Commonwealth of Virginia's Hampton attorney and the chief of police, they scheduled a grand jury hearing. Now, normally, a grand jury hearing is used as the final steps before charges are brought against a subject. The grand jury will decide, after hearing all of the evidence, whether or not there is enough to move forward with prosecution. Unfortunately, the attorney for the Commonwealth had decided that there was not enough and that this was just going to be an opportunity to lay out the case for a grand jury and get some feedback on their perspective of things. Of course, this greatly upset Meyer, who had poured years into the case at this point, and he reaches back out to this agent that he had worked with, one Liza Ludovico. The agent suggests running the case past the assistant state's attorney general. Basically, what this means is if the attorney general agrees to hear it, they will take the case from Hampton and it will become a federal case, meaning the federal government is now involved and is backing it. Meyer thinks that this is a good idea, and he gets permission from both the Commonwealth Assistant Attorney and his Chief of Police to move forward with this. Virginia's Assistant Attorney General is eager to take control of the case, so that's what ends up happening. On May 15th, 2015, the Assistant State's Attorney General, Phil Figura, went to the Hampton Police Department, where he got an official rundown of the case, and a few days after that, he officially announces to the Hampton Police Department that he will be taking over prosecution of this case. The FBI's Behavioral Science Unit gets involved. For those unaware, that's the unit within the FBI that specifically deals with serial killers. And that is what Reuben Moore is believed to have been, although he's only going to end up being convicted of Olivia Christian's murder. There are too many similarities and too many ties between Reuben Moore and these various other victims for him to be anything else. Reuben Edward Moore was one of 15 children. His birth date is variously listed as February 3rd, 1950 and June 30th, 1950. He was born in Ahoskie, North Carolina. His parents were Clarine and James Moore. Clarine was 13 when she married Reuben's father, and over the next several years, she proceeded to pop out numerous children with both his father as well as with another man, a preacher by the name of Henry Smallwood. And it's interesting to note that the fathers for the various children are actually listed on their birth certificates, and it seems as though Reuben's father had no problem with this for a period of time up until his mother moved to Newport News with the Reverend in 1960, leaving behind all of her children with James Moore, who is listed as being an alcoholic and not present. So Reuben ends up being raised for a period of time by his older brothers before eventually moving to Newport News to live with her mother and the Reverend Smallwood, whom Mrs. Moore had married. Reuben Moore was noted as being unable to read or write and repeatedly failed classes in school, dropping out at the age of 14 and taking a job working as an unskilled laborer. From that point forward, Reuben Moore is continually in trouble with the law, starting with the sexual assault he committed and which he was sent to a juvenile detention center for. In 1973, while in prison, he marries his first wife, Carolyn Ann Langford. Upon his release from prison in 1979, Moore ends up landing a job with the Newport News Shipbuilding Company, where he works until 1982, only being released after the Worley rape occurs. He ends up having three children with his first wife, the last of whom, a daughter, was born on June 15, 1982, and the FBI came to believe that the later stages of his wife's pregnancy had been a stressor on Reuben Moore, which caused him to rape Worley. After being convicted, Moore's first wife stands by him for a few years, unaware that he is having an affair with a woman by the name of Deborah Benita Solomon. Moore's first wife officially divorces him in 1987, and he is paroled in 1997, beginning a relationship with Deborah that eventually leads to their marriage. Moore claims from this point on to have found Jesus. On December 11th, 2015, the case against Reuben Moore in the murder of Olivia Christian was brought before the grand jury by the state's assistant attorney general. They obviously moved to indict. At 11:30 a.m., the Virginia State Police contacted Reuben Moore, informing them that he needs to come down to their headquarters to update his sexual offender photograph. Upon arriving at the police station, Moore is escorted into a small back room, and after a few moments, two men entered, a detective from the Hampton Police Department and an FBI special agent, who inform Moore that he is under arrest for the murder of Olivia Dare Christian. Moore protested as he was patted down and handcuffed, stating that he was only there to have his picture taken. After which, Moore is driven to an FBI field office in Newport News. It's pretty amazing to note that Reuben Moore had not by this point requested an attorney represent him. So Moore is led into a interview room where a scene straight out of a Hollywood movie has been set up. There are charts and graphs and maps and crime scene photos of all the various crimes that Moore has been convicted of or charged with or suspected of, lining the walls of this room. And he's left in there for a period of time before Special Agent Ludovico to interview Moore. And she approached this under the guise of her religious faith. After an intense stare down, the interview of Reuben Moore officially begins with the agent reading Moore his Miranda rights, which he signs. During the course of the interview, Reuben continuously puts his actions on the devil. That is the being known as Satan in Christianity. He never takes responsibility for his own actions, stating at one point that everything he ever did was to help support his family and his brothers. The agent stops him at this point and says, quote, "You've talked about providing money to support the family. Everything in front of us is not about you taking property or money or something of value that can be exchanged for money to support the family. Everything is all about you taking something from someone else that has no value to anyone else but you." However, she is eventually able to get him to admit that he had sexually assaulted Minnie Selby in 1968, as well as stabbed her, leaving her for dead. She also gets him to admit that he had gone back to the Wolf residence in order to intimidate his victim. When the Worley case is brought up, Moore states that he needs a break as this particular case had no justice to it. They take a break, after which Moore talks again about the demons, particularly the devil taking control of him. He eventually admits to having raped Denise Worley. At one point, the agent asks Moore if he believes that God fixes things, to which Moore replies, "If God fixed this, I might die in jail." However, he refuses to admit to the murder of Olivia Christian, recanting his earlier statements, expressing that everything that the agent was saying about him, all of the crimes, were all lies. This is, again, a common tactic of a serial killer who does not want to take ownership of their crimes. Ted Bundy did this for years and years and years, until finally confronted with the possibility that he was going to be executed, at which point he switched tactics and agreed to start confessing, hoping that this would save his life If you listen to the series on Bundy, however, you know that he did not. Still, other serial killers openly admit to their crimes. A perfect example of that would be Gary Ridgway, who, in exchange for not getting the death penalty, told officers everything that they wanted to know as far as the cases that they had information on. In the case of Moore, he eventually clams up and the interview can go no further. Unlike the Denise Worley case from 1982, where his wife had stood by him, Moore's current wife does not stand by him, stating that he had told her a fabricated version of events, that he was being railroaded for having consensual sex with this woman. Stories he also peddled to his relatives, which they believed, with one sister having gone so far as to provide alibi witness testimony at each one of his trials. Some people might question that and wonder how a sibling, let alone a woman, can testify on behalf of a man who is accused of horrific sexual assaults and murders. And really, it comes down to the fact that they're blood relations. No one wants to think the worst of somebody that they're related to, particularly one of their siblings. And psychologists have stated that they oftentimes will block out the part of their mind that has doubt and instead focus on the person that they actually know versus the person they are being told their sibling is. Reuben Moore is officially arraigned on December 12, 2015. At first, he retains his own attorneys, but when that becomes financially unfeasible, he refuses to have any attorneys before eventually accepting a public defender. And the trial is actually set to begin on December 1st and 2nd of 2016. However, eventually Moore's counsel is going to waive his client's right to a speedy trial and request a continuance. And this goes on over the course of the next 2 years. Now, the defense had a much easier case than the prosecution, who really didn't have a lot of physical evidence to tie Reuben Moore to the murder of Olivia Christian. They were also precluded from bringing up any of his earlier crimes. Fortunately, I was not able to find any information as to why this was the case, as to me, they show a pattern. However, the judge would not allow it. So many in law enforcement started to look at this case as one that was going to remain unsolved in an unwinnable situation, especially when you include the fact that Anita Purcell had originally recanted her statements to police. She was the prosecution's star witness, and many saw this recantation as evidence that, you know, she was an unreliable witness and as an avenue for the defense to exploit. Now, while he's in jail at the Hampton Roads Regional Jail, Moore has a conversation with his sister on the phone, despite knowing that all phone conversations are recorded. On the morning of December 17th, 2016, Moore spoke with his sister Gloria Davis, who's the sister that had given him alibi testimony in each of his trials. His sister eventually asks Moore about what happened in 1981. Quote, "Have you ever been there?" Moore, "Yeah, there's some apartments back there." I've been there. I've seen what they're talking about. I used to wash my clothes there, you know. They got a laundromat, and then there's a side cut. This testimony's going to come back and bite more in the ass. Because, if you'll recall, up until this point, at least to law enforcement, Moore has steadfastly refused to admit that he was aware of where Olivia Christian lived, and in fact told them he had no idea where the street even was. Well, the prosecution is going to be able to get this recording and later put it into evidence during the trial. Reuben Moore's trial officially begins on March 12th, 2018, with jury selection, which lasts an entire day. For opening arguments, the prosecution paints a picture of Moore as a vicious, bloodthirsty man. Now, remember, they cannot bring up any of his past crimes, so they simply have to rely on the facts of Olivia's murder. And he tells the jury that he has a witness who can place Reuben Moore at the scene of the crime. He also states that they're going to hear how this woman felt intimidated back in 1981 by the police to change her story, before ending his opening statement by stating, quote, "There's going to be a lot of evidence, and you're going to have to wade through it all, but at the end of this process, we will be asking for a conviction for first-degree murder." The defense's opening statement rested largely on the idea that someone else had done this crime and that Reuben Moore was being railroaded for it, stating at one point, quote, "When you look at the apartment and see the brutal crime, it's somewhat amazing that the Commonwealth, the state, never came up with any kind of DNA evidence. Nothing from the victim, no positive proof of somebody in particular who had done this." Before turning his attention to Anita Purcell, stating, quote, "She actually contacted the police and said, 'I know who did it.' So they bring her in, and they start questioning her. She says, 'No, that's not true. I made all this up.'" Before informing the jury that the prosecution's entire case rests solely on the identification of this single witness. But once the trial begins, the prosecution starts calling witnesses, friends of Olivia, co-workers, her former boyfriend, officers who worked the trial, before getting to Anita Purcell. Anita gives a fairly powerful testimony, pantomiming the actions she saw the man take on the day that Olivia was murdered for the jury to see. And then, on more than one occasion, pointing to Reuben Moore as the perpetrator that she had witnessed in the parking lot that day outside of Olivia's apartment and then driving away. And when asked by the prosecution how she could be so sure, she repeatedly said she could never forget that face or forget those eyes. When pressed as to why she had recanted her story to the police in 1981, Anita states that there was so much pressure from law enforcement on her. Remember, Anita was 16 years old, that she just wanted it all to stop. And after an 8-hour interview, during which time she was given no breaks or food, she finally decided she'd had enough and came to the conclusion that the only way to get the officers to leave her alone was to lie and tell them that she had made the entire thing up. You have to remember, the police in 1981 were heavily focused on Michael. And Anita, from the very beginning, stated that it was not Michael that she had seen. when she encountered Michael, was shown pictures of Michael, she stated that the resemblance was similar, but it was not him. On cross-examination by the defense, they jump all over this, and they start throwing out statements that they're alleging Anita had given to police, which she never did. And really what this is the defense trying to get Anita to perjure herself on the stand by stating, yeah, I said that, and this is why, when she never said these things. Unfortunately for the defense, Anita never admits to having said anything that she never said. Another rather dramatic moment in the case came when the original investigating officer took the stand after Anita and walked the jury through what he encountered on the evening of September 4th, 1981, starting with pictures from outside the apartment, then moving inside of the apartment, and eventually to Olivia's bedroom, where crime scene photographs of her dead body were shown. This elicited groans and whimpers from the jury. This was further driven home when the alarm clock used to strangle Olivia was presented in court and to the jury by this officer. On cross-examination, the defense tried to play on the fact that this officer was over 70 years old and maybe suffering from some memory lapses. However, every time they attempted to do this, such as giving him inconsistent dates of when things happened or different exhibit numbers, he would correct the defense counsel. When asked about DNA, the officer informed the defense that there was no DNA technology in 1981, but they did take blood swabs from the victim, as well as look for any foreign matter which may have been connected to the perpetrator. They then heard from residents in the apartment building, who all spoke of her glowingly. One resident, who was a teenager at the time and lived above Olivia, spoke of how kind-hearted and good she was, how she would allow the young girl to come down to her apartment when her mother wasn't there, and the young girl became frightened, particularly when there were rainstorms. The woman then broke down on the stand as she described hearing the sounds of a struggle from somewhere in the apartment complex, the cries for help and for someone to stop, as she did not realize they were coming from Olivia's apartment and simply thought that they were a domestic dispute. And she discussed how she had relived that moment over and over again, and how every time she spoke of it, she relived it again. Even the defense was unable to really do much with this witness because her testimony was so powerful. The next witness that the Commonwealth called was Denise Worley, and while she was forbidden to discuss the rape that had occurred, she was able to speak about the stalking that had occurred. She was also able to identify Reuben Moore from his booking photo, describing before having seen it what he usually wore when he came to her place of business, as well as the car that he drove, before pointing out Moore in the courtroom. The defense did not ask Worley any questions. After this, they spoke to the officer who had detained Moore on the afternoon of June 10th, 1982, as he left Miss Worley's apartment. And while they were not able to bring up any of the information regarding the rape that had occurred, The officer, through his testimony, was able to tie Reuben Moore to the car, the Ford Galaxy. As with Miss Worley, the defense declined to ask any questions. The prosecution then called the detective who had broken Olivia's case, Detective Randy Meyer. He walked everyone through his job and how he had come to work Olivia's case. The majority of his testimony concerned the recorded interviews he had done with Moore, particularly the lies he had told during the various interviews, such as the fact that the 65 Ford Galaxy was not him, and having never been to the Ivy League apartment complex. Meyer spoke of Moore's reaction to the implication that there may have been a relationship between he and Olivia, stating, quote, "I don't even have that mindset anymore. If you rush out there and try to get a conviction on me, this is ridiculous because I'm trying to move past my past life." I'm going to read a little bit of the trial transcript here. Figueroa: "What did he say about where he was that morning?" Meyer: "At first he said that he would have been sleeping, then he told me that he would have worked at 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. that morning and would have gone to bed, and then he just switched tense from past tense to the present. He said, 'Reuben wouldn't have killed nobody, I know that.'" Figueroa: "You said something about a switch?" Meyer: "When we spoke about that particular time frame, the day of the murder, he just continually switched as if it was a third person. It was like that person, Reuben, was a different person, like he was distancing himself from talking about the murder." Figueroa: "Did you confront him about there being a witness who saw him from across the street?" Meyer: "I flat out told him. I said, 'Someone saw you out there.' And he immediately said, 'I don't remember seeing nobody.'" Figueroa: "What, if anything, did he say about demons?" Meyer: "He said, 'The only reason you can say whatever the past was, it was driven by demons. I don't have them demons no more. I admit I was mean as hell one time.'" Figueroa: "What else did he say about demons?" Meyer: "He said, 'I can remember being driven by demons.' And then I said, 'Well, what would they make you do?' And he said, 'Whatever I wanted to do. You just do what you want to do. Rebellious.'" Figueroa: "What did he say about people actually being told what to do by these demons?" Meyer: "He said he did it out of pure hell meanness." Figueroa: "When you asked him about what he did back in the 70s and 80s, what did he say?" Meyer: "He responded, 'I did what I wanted to do. I was rebellious because of the system. The system was dirty. He said blacks have always caught the hell, but if there was something I thought I could get away with, I'd do it. I'd do whatever I wanted to do. I just did it.'" Figueroa: "What, if anything, did he say about why people do things?" Meyer: "He said, 'I know why people do things because I've walked on both sides of the street. I'm not on that side no more. And I know what had driven me. It was like, you got a thing for white woman or whatever. I was just a macho black man, and this is something I can't have. What made me do it? If I put out candy and told you that you can't have that candy, that's why. Because I'm human. I have a right to it. But you can't have it. It was just a racial thing. Racial.'" Then men moved on to talking about Reuben Moore's health and what he had told Detective Meyer concerning his stroke. Quote Meyer: "He showed me a scar on his neck. He told me he had suffered a stroke since I had last seen him, and he said, 'Meyer, sooner or later I'm going to croak anyway. You follow what I'm saying? I've been living a quiet life. What's in the past is in the past.'" They then turned to the phone call that Moore had made to his sister, the CD recording of which had been introduced into the trial as Exhibit 27 and was at this point played. And it's at this point that Meyer reveals that Reuben, who had repeatedly insisted he had no idea where the apartment complex was, told his sister he had in fact been there and was very familiar with it as he used to do his laundry there. Stating, he said that he had no idea what area I was talking about, even showing him a map of the area. He said he'd never been there. He was not familiar with area, and his wife had to show him the area I was even referring to. At this point, it was the defense's turn to question Detective Meyer. Basically, the beginning of his questioning focused on the fact that there was 3 years between his interview with Detective Meyer and his phone call with his sister, trying to implicate that Moore had become familiar with the area after his interview with Detective Meyer. They were, however, able to get Meyer to admit that he had lied to Moore about DNA, specifically the hair being matched to him exclusively, in an effort to elicit a confession from him. When asked if that was a normal police tactic, Meyer stated that yes, it was, and that an innocent person will react differently to being given this news than a guilty person will. Before admitting that Moore continued to deny his involvement in the crime even after being told this. After this, it was 5 p.m. and the judge concluded the trial for the day. It began the next morning at 9 a.m. and the prosecution continues to go on with their case, laying it out piece by piece how Reuben Moore had been tied to Olivia Christian's murder. Eventually getting to FBI Special Agent Liza Ludovico. And she spoke of how she became involved in the case and also how she had spoken with the Behavioral Sciences Unit at Quantico, the FBI headquarters, in order to be able to construct and conduct the third and final interview with Reuben Moore when he was taken into custody. How the room had been designed to have a psychological impact on Moore in the hopes of eliciting a confession from him. And as we already discussed in this episode, while Moore did admit to some of his crimes, he would recant that statement later on, saying that it was all lies and would not admit to having committed the murder of Olivia Christian. After Ludovica's testimony, there was a recess. The state rested its case, and then it was the defense's turn. Their first witness was the original investigating officer. Basically, the whole drive of the defense's questioning of this officer was to show that both that he had a faulty memory and that Anita Purcell was a liar and that her testimony could not be trusted. Amazingly, after the testimony of this officer, the defense rested their case. With the jury returning from lunch at 12:45 p.m., after giving the jury their instructions that they could find Moore guilty, not guilty, or that the case had not been proven, and reach a hung jury, both sides began to present their closing arguments. The prosecution began, quote, on September 4th, 1981, Hurricane Reuben blew into town. Hurricane Reuben, the man who said, if there's something I thought I could get away with, I would do it. Who said, if I put candy out and told them you can't have that candy, that's why. But I'm human, I have a right to it, it's a racial thing. Hurricane Reuben blew into town, and what did he see? He saw this lovely young lady, Olivia Dare Christian. See, there was candy out there, and he wanted that candy, and that candy was Olivia Christian. Miss Christian was a virgin, and she didn't want to give him the candy, and he killed her for it. When he didn't get what he wanted at 7:30 that morning, he tied the alarm clock radio cord around her neck and choked the life out of her. Now think about that. Strangulation is different than any other kind of murder. It's very personal. You can let go at any time, give a breath of air. He had her face down with the shirt over her head, see? The shirt is not down there It is over her head and on the back and pushed up on the front. He was trying to get his candy. She wouldn't let him have it. After this, Figueroa walked the jury through every witness testimony that he had presented, as well as every piece of evidence that he had presented to them. When the defense got up, they began their closing arguments with, quote, "I'm not going to appeal to your emotions. I'm not going to refer to her as candy or him as Hurricane. What he's just talked to you about is not evidence. This go back 36 years. It's almost like a time machine that we've been in. You've seen the beautiful pictures of Olivia. She appeared to be stunning. We see her boyfriend and we say he looks really old. That was her good friend from school. She looks very old. I have trouble using the term star witness because I don't know if she was a witness at all. She certainly gave a story at one point, but then within a fairly short period of time, she totally recanted." The defense based the rest of their closing argument on the fact that there was no DNA evidence, but most specifically on the fact that Anita Purcell had recanted her original statements to police, and therefore nothing that she said could be believed. As in any trial, the prosecution is allowed to present a rebuttal to the defense's closing arguments. This time through, Figueroa focused on the many lies that Reuben Moore had told officers, reminding the jury that Reuben Moore had been placed both at the scene of the crime by an eyewitness as well as inside of the car by multiple witnesses, that he had claimed the car was not him until a later period of time when he admitted that the car was his. How Moore had stated that he, quote, "don't remember seeing nobody," and speaking of the crime as though it was in a third person, almost like a movie he had seen. Quote, "Reuben wouldn't have killed her." After this, the judge gave the jury one final set of instructions and sent them to decide Reuben Moore's fate. Eventually, the jury does reach a verdict, finding Reuben Moore guilty of second-degree murder of Olivia Dare Christian. After a brief celebration at Olivia's grave, it was eventually time for Reuben Moore's sentencing. He is sentenced to 40 years behind bars for the murder of Olivia Dare Christian, essentially a life sentence. Members of law enforcement maintain to this day that Reuben Moore was a serial killer, even though he was only convicted of one murder and that in the second degree. Given the evidence that we have on him, all of the things that we know concerning his criminal history and murders that were tied to him, along with various rapes, and his inability to take responsibility for his own actions, I think it's safe to assume that Reuben Moore is in fact a serial killer. Although he's a serial killer most people probably will never hear about, as this case unfortunately did not make big national headlines when Moore was found guilty and sentenced to 40 years in prison, where he remains to this day. I hope you guys enjoyed this deep dive on the murder of Olivia Dare Christian. Until next time, stay morbid.